The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello! And welcome to the most special edition of Slate Money. I think we should call it the godly edition of Slate Money, because we are getting religion this week.
Holy shit, we're godly.
Exactly.
Adjectives that have never been disused to describe Slate Money.
I'm feeling super godly.
I feel like we've been doing Slate Money for over 100 episodes now. We've been going for a while, and this is a big gaping gap, a lacuna, you might say.
Yes.
In what we've been talking about.
Oh my God.
We've been talking about money and money and money and society, and we have not talked about religion, which is a key part of how people think about money, why people think about the money in the way they do. And it's a big business. And so we have in the studio, quite aside from Cathy O'Neill, the atheist blogger and at mathbabe.org.
And I really don't know anything about religion. I'm super interested in this topic.
And quite aside from Jordan Weissman, the I guess Jewish money box columnist at Slate.
Shockingly.
and me, Felix Salmon, the atheist senior editor at Fusion, I went to a school which was Christian, and so there were a few kind of pro forma Himmy Prairie things every so often.
Yeah, but this was in England.
Did you learn anything, though? Like the Bible verses or anything?
Oh, God, no.
Okay.
so to speak. And we have – but never mind us, because we actually have an expert here. Chris Lehman.
Lehman. It's important to distinguish from the investment bank.
Yeah, so it's not Lehman as in brothers, but right. Lehman as in, you know
– a lay preacher, let's say.
Yes. has written the book. Tell us very briefly, like, who you are and what is this book?
I am, as you noted but mispronounced, Chris Lehman. I am editor of The Baffler. Until very recently, like 2 weeks ago, I was co-editor of Book Forum. And I have written a lot on the money culture broadly. My last book was called Rich People Things, which was based on a column I wrote long ago at The All. It does feel in, you know, I'm at a table now of three secular slash atheist journalists. I've had a lifelong interest in religion as an outsider. As an undergraduate, a religious studies major, I just soaked the stuff up in a way that was mystifying both, I think, to my family and myself. But, you know, I grew up in the Midwest where religion is a huge part. You know, I was not raised religiously. My parents, when they felt guilty, would drag me to a Unitarian church every now and then. It's just sort of checking the box. But I was surrounded by very ardent, very Protestant religious people, you know, schoolmates and such. And I remember having to explain to them what Unitarianism was. They always thought it was the Unification Church. It was like, I remember talking to my parents, like, do I have to go through this? This is like embarrassing. Which is all a long way of saying there was this huge presence in my, you know, social world that I knew nothing about. And I just gradually, when I went to college, began to think of it in a more systematic way and thinking, you know, this is this very powerful, irrational force that does, in fact, determine a great deal, especially in the United States, about the way we think about, you know, moral values, how society should be organized, and the economy.
Okay. So the name of the book is The Money Cult. That, I think, is a good place to start. Sure. American Christianity, and most American religious people are Christian, the overwhelming majority. American Christianity is a big money thing, right?
Yeah. Both would you call in terms
it,
of...
Would you call it a money cult?
I'm glad you asked me that, Felix. Yes. So actually, in fairness, my agent, Melissa Flashman, gave me the title, so I just ran with it. But I would nonetheless and do describe it as a money cult in the sense that not, I think in the traditional, we have this kind of caricature, you know, that we in the media often foment of, you know, the kind of Elmer Gantry on the make preacher who always turns out to be a sexual hypocrite, who always turns out to be in it for the money. I hope I'm not writing about that stereotype because that's not my view of how money figures into American religious belief. It's actually a much more intimate and foundational idea. And I was surprised when I, you know, it is a history going back to the colonial settlement of the country. And, you know, like the first great American evangelist who was technically British, George Whitefield, the preacher who led the First Great Awakening, which by many historical accounts was the key event that led to the American Revolution. It gave the country a sense of national unity. That's all off to the side. But Whitefield came over on a ship and landed in Philadelphia with a hoard of goods that his brother, who is a wine merchant, had him sell. So the first notice of George Whitefield's arrival was like, there are exotic rugs, there are bottles of wine. You know, it was an open-air bazaar.
Commerce.
And yeah, exactly. And George Whitefield also was a in the print culture of the early colonies, he personally accounted for something like 40% of all printed matter, like his sermons, his you know, dispatches. He actually hired a publicist, which was unheard of.
And he made money selling these things?
He did, though. He, like many people who make money and many religious people who make money, he managed it incredibly badly. Most of the money went to an orphanage and, you know, sort of religious complex he was founding in the colony of Georgia, and it just sank.
but there's been a lot of money in religion since long before the founding of the United States. I mean, the Catholic Church is famously just awash in money.
Yes.
It seems that money is something which naturally follows on from power. Like if you're powerful, you wind up with money. And that certainly in Europe for most of the past 1,000 years, a huge amount of power has resided in the church. And so it's kind of logical that you will also wind up getting a lot of money there. In the United States, which is a nominally secular country with the separation of church and state, is it the same dynamic in a just a slightly more diluted way that even though we don't have the religious people running the country, they still have power in society and that's how they get money?
Yes and no. It's organizationally very different from the European Catholic model. And I describe this a lot in the book. One of the big themes of Protestant revival and Protestant denominationalism in America, is about deinstitutionalizing. There's a distrust of all forms of earthly power, because they're not holy. And they're not of the new world. They are associated with old world corruption. So anytime a church is seen to, you know, gain too much worldly influence, you know, there's this kind of reflex of, oh shit, we're becoming Catholic and, you know, go to hell, literally. So it's an interesting dynamic. And in the book, these ideas kick around in your head for a long time. And I suddenly realized that, you know, as a historical fact, religion is the first deregulated industry in America. The last state-supported church was dissolved in 1820 in Massachusetts, which was, the mother colony of the Puritans. And from that point, you have this total, and, you know, what follows in the early 19th century at the same time is what's known as the Second Great Awakening, which is an amazing onrush of people who are, you know, inveighing against traditional religious establishments and saying, look, I've discovered Christ. No, I've discovered, you know, it's a nationwide revival that just seizes the American imagination and creates, among other things, Mormonism, which is one of the, you know, the other themes of the book is Mormonism and Pentecostalism are kind of the leading edge money cult denominations, in my view.
So, can you talk a little bit about the only actual religious exposure I had as a child, which was that my grandmother used to watch the TV evangelists.
Oh, yes.
And like, because that seems like a very, going to Felix's question, very American phenomenon.
It is. And it's American in this way I'm describing, because the vast majority of TV evangelists either switch their denominational affiliations willy-nilly, like Oral Roberts, who is a great Pentecostal preacher in the 70s and helps develop what's, you know, what is now called the prosperity gospel, which is the most, you know, hardcore iteration of the money faith, became a Methodist, and it freaked everyone out.
Now the prosperity gospel is basically if you give money to the church, then you will become rich.
That's, yeah, at the most basic transactional level, that's true. That's not what happened.
In reality.
I'm curious, this is part of it, but I mean, I'd like you to talk about how we got to that point.
Yes.
How did we evolve to the point where religion becomes that kind of hardcore transactional? Like, and how is it different than what came before?
That is the story of my book, yeah. So I am very glad you asked that as well. We evolved through this process of kind of rabid deinstitutionalization. So all these denominations I talk about in the book, like Mormonism, like Pentecostalism, also have this fevered romance that they're going to rediscover the primitive church. This is, again, going to Felix's earlier point, a very American idea. Like, we're going to shuck off all of the old world corruption. You know, we're a democracy. You know, we're going to be in an original relationship with God, as Emerson broadly put it. How we get to this point is, you know, from the early 19th century onward, every sort of major Protestant founder of a new denomination or, you know, influential evangelist says, we're going to take you back, you know, to the way the gospel was worshiped by Paul and all the disciples in the immediate wake of Jesus's death. Now, the interesting thing about this is the primitive church was also essentially socialist. They held
property. They sound like a bunch of hippies in the woods.
No, they totally were. They held property in common. They, you know, until Paul sort of got them under control, they would let women, you know, play, you know, leadership roles. So this is a big problem, right? Yeah. We're going to revive the Puritan church or the primitive church, but because we're Americans, like, it's not going to be socialist. Duh.
God forbid.
Right. God forbid. You know, this process actually of divesting power away from, you know, solidaristic institutions into charismatic individuals creates, you know, the social dynamic where powerful evangelical preachers become obsessed with money as a sign of your faith. And going back to what you're asking about the prosperity gospel, part of what the prosperity gospel preaches is that the words from your mouth create your social reality. Joel Osteen is this is called the word of faith tradition. Joel Osteen, who is still amazingly, both before and after the 2008 meltdown, the most popular preacher in America today. And it is all about creating an abundance theology, having a, you know, success outlook on life. It is the business culture of kind of successories and motivational posters. Translated entirely.
Sorry. I had to interrupt you. What is a successory?
Successories are this kind of kitschy, or at least I regard them as kitschy, line of, you find them in office, middle management offices all the time. They're just sort of
like those posters
right, that have inspirational quotations about how you are going to achieve tremendous things.
So it's a cult of personality.
It is, in a certain way. Personalities certainly predominate, and the story of how we get from, you know, where we were, you know, as, you know, kind of proto-social gospel Puritans to today's marketplace of religious, you know, some may call it hucksterism.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
So, but going back to the money thing, there's this other very profound part of religion, and as a tourist in this area, I feel like this is the thing which I see a lot, which is vows of poverty, which is like you should give your money to other people, probably the church. You should, you know, it is easier for a camel's hair to pass through the eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Right. Like, there's this
a camel's hair can pass through.
Or whatever
just
it is.
For the record.
But
I was thinking about that.
I've investigated.
So I feel like when I think of religion, a lot of the time I think of, you know, monks and nuns with no money. I think of priests working, you know, where I grew up in the Church of England on very low salaries.
Yeah, non-materialistic.
You're thinking of European religion is what you're thinking.
So is that – now, so – that's, I guess, no, that's my question.
There is,
we also have in Europe the Catholic Church, which has lots of money. So.
Right. Now, there is definitely a strong philanthropic and charitable function. You know, I don't want to portray American religion as solely a get-rich-quick scheme. It's not that. And a lot of – like Joel Osteen has a mission of, you know, sending – goods to Africa. Rick Warren has adopted Rwanda as a purpose-driven country to remake. But that is a good example, in my view. Like, you know, here you have, an enormously influential pastor at a megachurch adopting a country to not just, you know, help a country recovering from a genocide get back on its feet, though he's doing a lot of good work along those lines, but branding it as a purpose-driven nation. That's a very different, and I would argue, distinctly American idea that, and this, you know, goes into a different discussion of America's imperial past, which, you know, probably isn't in our scope. But
is Joel Osteen himself, or are these pastors themselves, do they say that it's good to be poor? Or do they say that it's good to be rich? Because I feel like there is a tradition somewhere along the line. When I look at the priests and the monks and whatnot, and you know, St. Francis of Assisi or whoever, like, I feel like there is a tradition of it's good to be poor.
Yes, there is a tradition, and it is not the winning tradition in America. Joel Osteen.
So we in mega churches. Sorry, to interrupt. Mm-hmm. In mega churches, do I assume people who are in the flock give part of their money to the church?
Yes.
But they're not doing it to support the church. What are they doing it to show fealty? What are they – why? What's the purpose of the tithing?
They're doing it for – you know, people give money for a lot of different reasons. But the sort of theological rationale to give money and I've received these mailings from Joel Osteen myself – is you give money as an act of what's called seed faith. You plant a seed via your donation. – and God then allows you to prosper a hundredfold.
So it's like a Ponzi scheme.
Your words.
isn't this like just a really good example of kind of the market winning here? I mean, if you're trying to design a church that's going to be able to sustain itself and prosper, you'd want to appeal to white upper middle class Americans. And white upper middle class Americans don't want to be told about the virtues of poverty. They want to be told why they're virtuous. And so,
well, most of the point, I think, Americans who aspire to being upper middle
class. Yes, it is aspirational. So Joel Osteen embodies this. I don't know if you've ever seen him preach or like caught him on TV.
Can you do an impression?
You know, I was thinking I need to work up one. He has this kind of soft drawl, and he
overtone
of wonder where he is saying, and then God gave me a parking space. This is actually stuff he truly preaches.
In all fairness, I think there are a lot of people in this world who like do feel they have been touched by the hand of God if they get a parking space.
In New York City.
Especially in New York.
In New York City, yeah.
Like that's not outrageous.
That's a Seinfeld episode right there.
He also has a long description in one of his books. I actually reviewed one of his books for Slate where he describes, you know, he and his wife bought a new house without unloading their first starter house. They had two mortgages. They were struggling financially. Lo and behold, this was circa 2006 or so before the crash, obviously. Lo and behold, their old house sells and their new house flips instantly because it's zoned in a commercial development, a lavish commercial development in Houston. So its price doubles basically. And he says this was all the work of God, not the market. It was all because
housing bubbles are good and they are godly.
They are good and godly.
God wants housing bubbles.
Wait, so what happens when someone gets cancer? Are they like
simple? That is the whole big problem with this, the theodicy question, as it's called in theology, right? That how does a just and omnipotent God allow suffering to happen? And in economic terms, if God is smiling on Joel Osteen when he flips his house, he is, you know, angry, I guess, with the millions and millions and millions of Americans who then suffered, you know, foreclosure and from predatory mortgage markets. So that's a big problem.
Yeah.
And it's not one that, you know, this brand of preaching is –
Does that make this brand of preaching cyclical with the economy itself?
No, because as I said earlier, Osteen, you know, both before and after, that's what's fascinating to me.
Does he change what he was saying?
No, you don't need to. The great thing about this is it works both ways. In up markets, it's working.
And
it's
in down markets,
it offers you need it even aspiration. More. Right.
Yeah. Just give somebody the church and your house price is going to pop back up.
I don't understand how it works in down markets.
In down markets is when you need it the most.
Right. That is true.
You're waiting around for God to
you're
be just
planting
to
your
you?
Seed. Exactly. It is an investment. And it is spoken in the
best
terms.
The best time to invest is when blood is in the streets.
One fascinating thing to me about this is a lot of people have talked about how for some American conservatives, they've tried to sort of replace God with the invisible hand.
Yes.
And now this is almost like a reaction to the Christianity saying like, well, we'll just make the invisible hand into God.
Right. Now that is absolutely – that's a very good insight. That is in large part this, you know, the boring story that Felix doesn't want to hear about denominationalism in the 19th century is.
And trust me, I really don't want to hear that.
I so disagree with Felix. But unfortunately, we'll talk on the show, so I've got to defer.
No, Jordan and I will talk later.
Read the book, everyone.
Yeah, no.
Read the book and you get to learn all about denominationalism.
Yes.
So what we have got basically is this kind of confluence of capitalism and religion to the point at which suddenly the richest people are the godliest people just by dint of being rich.
Right. I think actually Donald Trump said something to this effect the other day that
you got to be great.
In order to be great, you have to be rich. And that is that is pure prosperity gospel. Actually, my friend Jeff Charlotte wrote a great piece for the Times Sunday magazine a while ago. He went to a bunch of Trump rallies in the heartland or primary states. And he came away saying, yeah, Donald Trump is a prosperity preacher. This is exactly the faith. And you know, when you think about it, it does make sense because, you know, we in the press examine Donald Trump's utterances as, you know, empirical, you know, and verifiable. And we fact check them and say, oh, you know, this will, it's not true.
But no one ever fact checks Joel Osteen.
Right. And for believers, that doesn't matter.
Yeah,
right?
it actually throws away rationality and logic.
That's how I got interested in religion is it is powerful, it is irrational, and it's a cohesive system that works. So how do you explain it? So, you know, I would argue in Donald Trump's case, you know, it's not the case that he opposed the Iraq invasion in 2003. It's not the case that, you know, the Mexicans are going to pay for the wall and the border. But the important thing for Trump devotees is he says something that they believe should be true.
They want it to be true.
Right. And that's exactly how word of faith prosperity preaching works.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
So, again, as a tourist in this area, one of the things I see when I look at religion, if I look at the Christian faith, there's a very long, thousands of years old tradition of debt jubilees where debts are forgiven. In Islam, there's basically a complete ban on debt. They really hate borrowing anything
immoral.
From anyone.
Right.
It's immoral. How does debt figure into this American version of Christianity?
In much the same way, interestingly, that prosperity does. I mentioned oral
like the more you have it, the better?
No, but you definitely acquire it. And it's in the 19th century, I'll just say quickly, debt shifts from the Puritan model of debt was like the Islamic model. It is a grave failing of character. It speaks badly of, you know, how of your upstanding nature. But that shifts in the 19th century, largely because there's it's what's called the market revolution in America. There's massive investment in infrastructure where tollways are built, state legislatures build canals. It's all funded by debt. It's all financialized debt on Wall Street. So debt then becomes a sign of, you know, trustworthiness in this kind of debt, at least. And if you're able to organize debt as Donald Trump does and sort of kite it, it's not necessarily that you're shady. It's that and this is actually where you get expressions like, give me some credit, that comes from this market revolution.
So it's associated with being trusted and with power.
Right, right. Because, you know, to contract debt is to place a lot of trust in your debtor or your creditor.
This is a bit like the seed planted in the ground. You can do that by giving money to the church, or in a weird way, you can do that in investing in yourself by borrowing money.
Right, right. Which is why, you know, I'm not sure that there's been research done on this, but I would not be surprised if say, you know, people who go to the University of Phoenix, who I hope is not one of your sponsors, are coming out of a prosperity gospel mindset or tradition.
It kind of, what you're saying though, kind of flies in the face of another kind of quasi-moral debt thing that is a big deal nowadays. It's like the Susie Orman version right. of like debt right. as personal, a moral sin.
Right. No, that is a throwback. And you know, Susie Orman, she's not a preacher. So
she kind of is.
She is.
You know, in a
and
certain
Dave
way.
Ramsey is certainly a preacher.
Right.
Like
no,
he
no.
Ha- and he's explicitly
he's on the radio?
Religious.
Is that guy?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. James Ramsey is.
Dave Ramsey is this another one of these personal finance gurus who inveighs against debt, tells everyone to pay down their debt as quickly as possible, and does so in an explicitly religious way.
There is still that tradition here that I'm, again, you know, I'm speaking in terms of general.
But you're saying that these personal finance gurus are kind of the counter current, and the main current is saying, go forth and lever up.
Yeah. Like when I mentioned Oral Roberts before, he was in he has a university in Oklahoma and a medical center, and they were both basically on the verge of bankruptcy back in the 80s. And he became, you know, something of a late night, you know, figure of fun on late night talk shows because he set forward a plea basically saying, like, to his flock, like, you are going to assume this debt or God is going to come and take me.
Well, he was suggesting people go into debt to help him out?
I think logically that probably follows in many cases.
How did that work out for him?
Fine.
How did it work out for his followers?
someone should do some follow-up research there. I'd be curious to know. But yeah, this is, you know, again, in the prosperity gospel version of the money cult, like, it is a good thing to leverage yourself.
You know, it's almost like a Silicon Valley approach. It's like almost goes full circle, like Silicon Valley. Yeah, like you'd be an idiot not to borrow a bunch of money to start a crazy
idea.
If you get
you know, the right venture capital, you could. That hadn't occurred to me. Thank you.
Kind of like God is venture capitalist.
That is what prosperity gospel.
That's
is.
And he Peter Thiel's next
and
book.
He will take his 2 and 20.
Right. No. That again, they don't. Yeah. You always read the small print. In this in this way, I want to echo Suze Orman.
So this is absolutely fascinating to me. The main thrust of American Christianity, it seems to tie threads together here to sort of completely fly in the face of what you might think of, like, poverty is good, debt is bad. It just turns that on its head and says poverty is bad, debt is good.
Yeah, there's one of the most influential works of American rhetoric, period, is a sermon called Acres of Diamonds by this 19th century preacher, Russell Conwell, who actually says all those things, that it is wrong in any event to be poor.
So I kind of a summary question.
Yeah.
In the end, how much do you think that American religion has conformed to American economics or American attitudes about money, and how much of American attitudes about money conformed to religion, which is the causal factor here?
It's surprisingly hard to separate out. You know, I'm immersed in the religious stuff, so I think I lean toward the idea that the Protestant money faith is what incubates the particular culture of American capitalism.
Okay.
I think you don't have the kind of economic thinking that we now have without it.
So
just a very simple.
So does that mean that the Protestant countries tend to have more sort of like aggressively capitalist
that is historically economies. True. That is historically
Let me
true.
Just say something really mm-hmm. meta though.
Okay.
I mean, it is much more sustainable economically for people to think that poverty is good, right? Because then they're like, they're all poor and they're like, yeah, this is cool. But it's very unsustainable to put people into Ponzi schemes and promise them riches because it doesn't work out and then they get burned and then they're pissed. but do they leave the religion or do they just migrate to a different megachurch? Like, what is the like long-term model?
Well, both American religion and American capitalism are prey to boom and bust cycles. It's definitely true.
Whereas the Catholic Church has managed to stick around for...
Yeah, and they're a steady state. You know, they're like a John Stuart Mill model. That's what's interesting. You know, Hard Times Faith... In the early 20th century, there was a rise of what's called the social gospel, which was very intellectually influential, less so in terms of mass denominational followings, that did try to, you know, wed a progressive kind of this capital P progressive agenda of social reform to Christian belief. It had a lot of different currents and tributaries. But what's interesting, like the most influential, the most popular social gospel tract was a book called Our Country by Josiah Strong. And in it, he actually says, Americans as a race, it is an extremely racist book, I should stipulate. Americans as a race have the gifts to make money. It is what we're from a northern climate. It's all that crap, all that eugenics crap, but it is all spiritualized.
That's amazing.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Just before we finish up here, like, can we expand this a little bit? Let's just expand it to the entire planet.
Absolutely.
I want to ask you this. Like, insofar as American capitalism and the American economy has sprung out of this kind of unique religious background, what does that tell us about the global economy? And specifically, as you know, in a world with, you know, a billion Muslims, where Islam just doesn't have this kind of flavor of Islam, doesn't exist anywhere.
Right.
Does that mean that, you know, Islamic countries are never going to have that kind of degree of economic success?
No, I don't think it is. It's not a law of economic development by any means. I just think you had, and one of the interesting things I also discovered, because one of the grand explanatory models for the relationship of Protestantism and capitalism is, of course, Max Weber's essay, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, which I puzzled over a long time trying to figure out how it fits and doesn't. And what's interesting is I realized that Weber's thesis, which, you know, in very short form is Protestant, you know, Puritans, Protestants who founded America, and Ben Franklin is sort of his personality type of this movement, have this, you know, they're insanely thrifty, they're insanely ambitious, yet they think God, you know, because they're Calvinists, they think God, it could just, you know, send them to hell at any moment for no reason at all. So this is actually what creates the impulse to accumulate and that creates, you know, this pool of venture capital, essentially. That's largely true, but I realized that basically the conditions Weber was describing were conditions of labor scarcity, because he says the problem for capitalists in dealing with religion is that the old world model, you do have things like debt jubilees, you have religious holidays. Like, there was no standard work week in early industrial England. Early modern England, I should say. You know, people would just, it would be some saint's holiday and people would get drunk for a couple of days and then they'd, you know, harvest the crops whenever. And so it was a big problem for people seeking to impose labor discipline. The Calvinist solution, in addition, Calvin also importantly wrote that usury was not really a problem. which was a big, that's another problem, you know, in the Catholic old world model. And I think speaking globally, yeah, there, for religious cultures that tend to, you know, discourage speculation as Islam does and, you know, usury, there is a different kind of idea of economic, and it's more cooperative. It's less individualistic. There's a much more kind of, you know, what we would call the traditional Catholic model of charity, what you were talking about with priests and monks. So it's there are, you know, the prosperity gospel does very well in South America and Africa. Africa is a big, big place where, you know, crowds turn out for Osteen and all the other prosperity preachers. So it's sort of an, you know, I don't know. There is no law that will predict economic development, but you could, I think, make the case that countries that fall under this way of a prosperity gospel kind of mentality are in for a lot of bumpy rides, a lot of bubbles, a lot of recessions.
Wow. So let's check back in 100 years and see how Rwanda is doing.
Put this podcast in the time
capsule. Talk about a macroeconomic model.
If Rwanda is the Switzerland of Africa,
and
but
then
when we
Rick
check back
Warren
in,
wins.
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay, so that is it for us this week. Many thanks to Chris Lehman for coming on and preaching the truth about American
the prosperity
capitalism.
Gospel.
We really, really appreciate it. Thank you, Chris. And thank you all for listening to Slate Money, which you can find in your iTunes store or anywhere else. Please subscribe to us. Please leave a review in the iTunes store. Write to us. The address is slatemoney@slate.com. Many thanks to Audrey Quinn, who produced this show, and to Steve Lichtai and Andy Bowers, the executive producers. Slate Money is part of the Panoply Network, so check out all of those podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. And we will talk to you next week on Slate Money.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.